You're listening to Stealing from Wizards, Volume 2, Burglary, by R.A. Consul. Chapter 24, Questionable Successes. The week started to whip by for Kuro. The relentless demands of school left little time for much else, and what free time he could find was largely spent visiting Bindle. He had become much more predictable and more eager to see Kuro, mostly due to the collection of candy he carried for the Luton. Their lessons had devolved into sessions of throwing rocks at the Veil. They both still tried to do the other's magic, but were losing hope that it was possible. It seemed increasingly clear that wizards couldn't do Luton magic, Luton couldn't do wizard magic, and Kuro couldn't do much of either. That is, until late one evening in early February, something struck Kuro. It wasn't a brilliant insight or a clever idea, it was a rock. Bindle had lobbed it from the far side of the Veil, and Kuro, not being able to see it coming, walked straight into it. It cracked him in the cheekbone, and in the moment of blind, vengeful anger that follows any blow to the face, Kuro instinctively fought back. He hurled the rock back from where it had come, neither looking nor thinking. He sank to the ground, clutching his throbbing face and wiping away the steady stream of tears from his one eye, as Bindle stepped through the Veil, wincing and clutching his shoulder. They both took breaths, ready to blame each other for the assault when the true consequence of the situation dawned on them simultaneously. The rock, rather than crossing the Veil and splashing harmlessly into the bay, had skipped over the bay entirely. It had ignored the whole notion of the Veil and traveled as though the two shores were connected, just as the Luton did.
"How did you do it?"
demanded Bindle.
"I don't know," said Kuro. "I just forgot that I couldn't for a minute."
He tried to remember what was going through his head when he threw the rock. Pain. It was mostly pain. But that pain had drowned out everything else. He didn't look at what he was doing. He didn't notice his surroundings or even try to aim. He just hurt and knew, in that moment, that he needed to send the rock back where it had come from. It was a little like the time in the cave when he had nearly summoned his familiar. He was tired and cold and afraid then, too distracted for his doubts to take hold. Neither head trauma nor mortal terror were the sort of things Kuro wanted to reproduce, but that experience proved it was possible. Kuro could do it, so long as he could forget that he couldn't. Bindle was eager to continue experiments with Kuro. Kuro declined at first, mostly because Bindle clearly expected most of these tests to involve throwing more rocks at him. Once they had agreed that bludgeoning Kuro wasn't a sustainable method, Bindle became more open to other options.
"I can follow you when you blink places, right?" Kuro said.
"Yes, it is very rude," replied Bindle.
"What if I can follow you?"
He was about to say through the Veil, but he realized that if that was the way he thought about it, it probably wouldn't work.
"If I hold your hand and close my eyes, what happens if you just pull me along?"
Bindle considered the option. He was curious enough to try it, even if it was less exciting than pelting Kuro with stones. Kuro shut his eyes and held tight to Bindle's hand as he was led blindly forward. He tried to focus on the hurt in his face and Bindle's grip, to forget about the whole world around him and any indication of where he was. His feet betrayed him, though. He could feel the uneven ground of the rocky shoreline and couldn't help but attend to it as he tripped along behind his guide. He felt something in his arms stretch out unnaturally, and doubt gripped him as he took another step forward. It felt as though his whole body were being stretched and squeezed simultaneously. A wave of pain and nausea overtook him, and he stumbled forward and vomited into the snow.
"It worked!"
Bindle clapped and danced at his success. He opened his eyes and found that he was in a different landscape altogether. No longer was he on Avalon at the edge of winter. He was elbow deep in snow in what could only be the Kingdom of Alfheim. Behind him was the wafting Veil, and beyond that, the raging ice-filled waters of the bay. Out of sight in the distance was Avalon Island. They just crossed miles of Blandland in a single step, as if the two shores were connected. It had worked. It almost hadn't. Kuro wondered if he would have been torn in half had it not.
but that was the very sensation that made him forget about his doubts and worry more about his innards being tied in knots. Bindle was so excited that he grabbed Kuro and pulled him back the other way. The trip back was less horrible, but only slightly. Kuro gave equal weight to the possibilities that it was because he knew it was possible and that his stomach was already empty. Bindle was eager to do it again. He celebrated his great and phenomenal power to drag a monster around wherever he wanted. Kuro was less inclined. The point had been made and he was sore and ill. He was able to stop his partner from inflicting any more harm with a suggestion. "If I can follow your magic," Kuro said, holding a cold, smooth stone to his swelling cheek, "maybe you can piggyback on mine."
"Explain better," ordered Bindle.
"Maybe I can cast the spell for you, or do the wizard half of it," he suggested.
"Yes," agreed Bindle. "That is good. Do it now."
Kuro had to admit he had no idea how to do it, but it sounded good. Bindle was annoyed that Kuro would offer an idea with such promise, and then fail to follow through on it immediately. He could only be soothed by a hearty application of gingerbread and jujubes. Kuro escaped without any other harm befalling him by assuring the Luton that he would do some research and come back with candy and ideas. Kuro was at a loss as to how to do the research, however. He couldn't think of a way to ask anyone without raising suspicions. He had to figure it out himself. The library seemed like the most logical starting point, but it was difficult since he was hesitant to ask the librarian for guidance, or even have her notice he was there. He slipped in undetected and prowled the rows of shelves in search of promising volumes. His hours of investigation over the week yielded some moderate successes, with a book about spells cast in pairs, and a story about someone helping a wizard complete spells after losing their arm. He also found something unexpected in the library. Marie. The fact that she'd isolated herself in the library wasn't surprising. She'd been gloomy and evasive ever since the incident with the gold on the ferry. Kuro felt terrible that his attempt to make her feel better had just driven her further away, but couldn't think of a way to fix it. He couldn't even bring himself to talk to her. He just watched her through the bookshelves before creeping away, unseen. He tried to work up the courage to face her each time he saw her there, but he ended up spying on her accidentally. He wouldn't have called it spying, except that she was doing something very strange. She wasn't doing homework or reading for pleasure. She was leafing through big old tomes and history books. For the first few days, Kuro tried to ignore it. He couldn't help but notice that she kept returning to the same section in the library every time he saw her. And the villain of curiosity quietly directed him past those shelves when he wasn't paying attention. It was the section on familiars. The source of Marie's gloom and her odd behavior crystallized for Kuro. She still couldn't conjure a familiar. She'd claimed months ago that it didn't matter, and that she had moved on to other things, but she'd been lying. Her nights alone searching for tree frogs, her refusal for aid, her self-isolation, and now her obsessive reading, it all pointed to the same thing. She'd been trying and failing to summon her familiar for months. She wanted it badly, but was afraid to admit it. Kuro couldn't blame her. He felt the same way, though maybe not so strongly. He wanted to offer to help her, to team up in their incompetence, but he was sure she'd refuse it. She'd probably deny that she even cared. Besides, the last time he'd tried to do something nice for her, they'd both ended up talking to the hounds. He thought that maybe, just maybe, if he could help Bindle succeed, then he might be able to genuinely give Marie some help that she needed. He resolved himself to the task. He'd help them both. He wouldn't even worry about whether it was possible. It didn't take very long before Kuro found his resolve wavering. While he was quite committed to the task, the rest of the world had failed to make any accommodations for his new obligations. It was difficult to engage in secret arcane delving in the library when it was full of other people. It was the time of year when every teacher was tired of giving lectures and grading tests, so instead they assigned large projects that kept the students out of their hair for a few weeks. That meant not only that the library was constantly populated by other students, but that Kuro was also burdened with several reports of his own, which ate into his research time. To add to Kuro's concerns, he'd heard that the Avalon Royal Defense League was on the hunt for him again. He had hoped that the return of the stolen goods and the long drought of burglaries would protect him from the wrath of Moira and Azalea, but that was not the case. He'd successfully dodged them for weeks, but his luck could only last so long. One evening, just before the school library closed, Azalea found him. He had hidden himself away in the back corner to avoid prying eyes, but that also left him cornered when she pounced. She whipped into his alcove, barring his exit, and demanded, "Did you read my journal?" It was more of an accusation than a question. What? Crow had no idea what she was on about. No, what journal? When?
The journal that you stole.
She balled her fists in anger.
You read it, didn't you?
A mote of clarity had entered the interrogation, and Kuro made a leap. The soggy book that had been with the other stolen goods was hers.
I didn't,
Kuro tried to soothe her.
I couldn't have if I wanted to. It was completely soaked.
I mean before you dumped it in a swamp for a week,
she shot back. Her normally pallid face was flushed, and Kuro felt the heat rising in the area. He quickly scanned for an escape, partly out of self-preservation and partly to save the library from being burned to the ground. There was a closed window nearby. That would do. An explosion of air burst it open and Kuro flung himself to safety. He plummeted earthwards, relieved to be out of danger, landed on a cushion of air, and dashed to freedom. He rightly guessed that Azalea wasn't prepared to follow him out the window, and the four flights of stairs would slow her enough that she'd no chance of catching him. The first thing he did, once he was certain he wouldn't need to start dodging lightning, was thank the wind. He didn't know if the coyote had been speaking literally about being loved by it, but he thought it good to be polite just in case. If the wind did have feelings, he had been pretty ungrateful up to that point. The next thing was to ponder what she'd said. She was right to be upset about her journal being taken and possibly read. He didn't blame her for her anger, but Arthur had said that his name was in the book, that it was about the only legible thing in there. It seemed likely that the journal was a lot like Arthur's folio of clues. It was probably full of notes on the burglaries that she wouldn't want her prime suspect gaining access to. The most interesting part, though, was what she'd said about how long it had been in the swamp. That was a curiosity he needed to share with Arthur. He found his roommate in the lodge lounge, already invested in his investigations. He was drafting floor plans of the residences and plotting the burglaries on them. He clutched his notes and complained at Kuro for bringing the wind inside with him. Once the breeze that had pushed Kuro across campus politely died away, Arthur reopened his notes and presented them to Kuro.
"Have a look at this," he said. "Where do you think the thief will strike next?"
Each burglary was carefully plotted on his maps with names of the victims and the dates of occurrence. Kuro's immediate inclination was that there was the opposite of a pattern. Every theft was in a completely different place, a different wing or floor of each residence. It looked so random that Kuro wondered aloud if that was intentional.
"I thought the same thing," said Arthur, reclaiming his maps. "But never trust to general impressions, my boy, but concentrate yourself upon details."
"My boy?" Kuro repeated, raising an eyebrow at his friend.
"It was in the book you gave me," Arthur explained, dropping his eyes to the floor. "Look, there have been at least two burglaries in each residence, and a boy and a girl in each as well."
"That's as spread out as they could be, isn't it?" concluded Kuro.
"Yes," said Arthur, "perfectly spread out. One burglary on every floor that a first or second year student might stay, except us. Nothing has happened here."
Kuro had only wondered a little about the lack of burglaries in the lodge. The students there were the least wealthy, and none of them was of any importance, so it was of no surprise that the lodge hadn't been raided. But it did make for a curious exception.
What do you think it means?
Arthur tapped his chin thoughtfully.
"Either the thief isn't interested in the lodge, or they can't get in."
"I guess the first," said Kuro. "The lodge is the easiest of them to break into."
Arthur raised a finger in protest.
"You said yourself that the burglar isn't robbing things the way you would. Maybe their methods don't work here. We would need more evidence to know for certain."
"Are you enjoying this?"
asked Kuro.
"Very much," replied his friend.
"Want another clue?"
Arthur scrambled for a fresh piece of paper, but Kuro wasn't going to give anything up so easily.
"When you opened the journal, how wet was it?"
"Very," replied Arthur as quickly as he could, so as not to delay the tantalizing clue. "Soaked through."
"And the mud?"
Kuro let his roommate drown in anticipation as he slowly confirmed his suspicions.
Had it soaked into the pages as well?
Yes, they were all brown.
And the ink, it had bled badly?
Nearly illegible, I told you. His pen hovered over the page, waiting for the new information Kuro had promised.
How long do you think the book would need to be in a swamp to get like that?
Arthur's features drifted as he processed that thought.
Days at least, he said. Weird, right? If they just wanted to get the scent off before returning them, they wouldn't need to soak them for days.
Arthur nodded his agreement and added, if they wanted to keep the things they stole, they wouldn't hide them in a swamp. They'd get ruined.
Kuro concluded the thought. And if they wanted to get rid of them, wouldn't they just tie them to a rock and toss them off the summer cliffs into the Blandlands?
Curious, said Arthur. Very odd.
You sound like your dad, replied Kuro.
Thanks. Despite the mountain of barriers being thrown up, Kuro still managed to find time to work with Bindle. It was always after dark and frequently in lousy weather, but they made the time, and they even made progress. Following Bindle through the Vale became easier with every trip across the bay, to the point that it wasn't even uncomfortable. Kuro just had to think about something else while it happened. With practice, he could do more than just follow. He could lead Bindle across. One night, something even more remarkable happened. As Kuro took Bindle's hand to pull him through the Vale, he found that they were already on the other side. Kuro shook his head as his senses worked to reconcile the new scenery with the lack of motion. Kuro was about to ask Bindle what had happened when he was cut off by a counter-accusation.
How did you do that? Demanded the Luton.
I thought you did it, replied Kuro.
No, said Bindle with absolute conviction. It was you. Do not take me places without permission.
Kuro was so busy apologizing that it took him a few minutes to realize what had happened. When it sunk in that he had blinked across the bay rather than walking through the Vale, that he had pulled Bindle rather than following, he was dizzy with excitement. It was a struggle to get Bindle to agree to try it again. Kuro was a monster, after all. He might do something terrible. It might be a trap. Kuro had to soothe and assure Bindle that they'd only go to the graveyard, that Kuro wouldn't try to take him anywhere dangerous. It took time to find the right frame of mind. Kuro had to forget about the rules of the world, ignore everything his senses were telling him, focus entirely on his inner feelings, and then just know where they were meant to be. When he opened his eyes, there they were. Without a step or a breath, they had crossed the bay and a good chunk of the island and were standing in the middle of the graveyard. Kuro was giddy with his newfound ability. It was more than power, it was freedom. He could grab hold of a Luton and be anywhere he'd ever been instantly. He could leave school and wander into Detritus Lane, never to be seen again. That freedom changed something inside Kuro. Avalon Academy had been a prison for him. He'd been forced by Talon Dubois to go and was unable to leave. The miles of freezing Blandlands water held him captive. Even if he had grown to like it there and had people he cared about and a warm bed and delicious meals, it was still a cage. The moment he'd blinked, however, the walls of the cage had fallen away. He could leave at any time. Not just to the frozen wilderness on the far shore, but back to Detritus and Bytown, where he could disappear and live the life he chose. That simple choice changed the island from a personal prison into the same school that everybody else was attending. Every day that Kuro woke up and had breakfast with his friends was another day that he'd chosen to stay. Kuro the inmate had been freed, and Kuro the student wanted to stay. He would have experimented endlessly with his newfound freedom, but he had obligations to Bindle. Teaching Kuro Luton magic was all in service of Bindle learning the wizarding ways. Kuro's success with the help of Bindle just reinforced the possibility of Bindle's success with the help of Kuro, and what started as a wild theory started to manifest effects. It was mostly trial and error. The books Kuro could find gave hints and ideas, but after that was guesswork and instinct. Given that neither of them had much in the way of wizardly intuition, Kuro was amazed that they had any success at all. Kuro only half understood what they were doing. It felt like he provided the raw materials while Bindle sculpted it. The first positive sign was misinterpreted as a large black leech dropping off the mausoleum roof. They both panicked when it appeared and Bindle hit it with a rock. Once they recognized that it was just how Bindle's familiar was going to come together, they overcame their discomfort and pressed on. Then, one day in early March, on a dark and sleet-filled evening at the edge of winter, it worked. A small army of wriggling black shapes oozed up from the ground and squirmed their way towards each other, knotting into a single long branching shape, like a twig made of slime. What Kuro imagined to be the skeleton of the thing emerged as the thing itself, the slimy surface crystallizing and hardening into a small, spindly creature. It had four delicate wings and six legs ending in sharp claws, a whip-like tail, and a long neck. Its whole body was covered in sharp armored plates, and its head had glittering faceted eyes and a mouthful of fangs.
"It's a dragon fey," said Kuro.
"Of course it is," replied Bindle.
Most people reacted to their familiars with a sense that they should have known all along and that it couldn't have been anything else. Bindle reacted with a sense that he had known all along, and Kuro should have known as well. It was unmistakably Bindle's familiar. It moved with the same twitchiness, bursts of speed with sudden stops to look around. It zipped around the graveyard with aggressive curiosity, sniffing and tasting things. They watched the creature figure itself out and explore the world until the cold soaked through them and weariness reared its head.
"I guess we should figure out how to unsummon it," said Kuro.
"No," Bindle refused. "It is too late. You keep it in your bag with my candy."
Kuro wasn't given a chance to argue. Bindle just grabbed his familiar, jammed it into Kuro's satchel, and vanished. Kuro wouldn't have minded keeping hold of the dragon fey for a couple of days if it had behaved itself at all. Familiars inherited pieces of their creator's personalities, and some of their knowledge and reason, but often not quite enough. Whether it was able to understand Kuro or not was irrelevant, as it had no interest in listening to him. Much like Bindle, it considered Kuro to be its subordinate, and Kuro spent the next several days trying to keep track of the creature. When it first escaped at dinner one night, he had to claim it was his own familiar to stop people from trying to kill it. He was initially praised for having such a cool and unusual familiar, but it quickly became trouble. It was impossible to keep it contained. It chewed through any leash or box he tried to keep it in, so it was constantly escaping. Also a trait it had clearly inherited from its maker was an appreciation for sweets. Kuro had to put the remainder of Bindle's candy palace in a drawer and then tie it closed to keep the beast from devouring it. Unlike Bindle, however, the dragon fey was extremely friendly and curious. It wanted to meet everyone and looked inside everything, regardless of whether those people wanted to meet it or would accept it exploring their possessions. Several times, the dragon fey returned to Kuro in a panic and hid in his bag for protection from the person it had just accosted. He spent a lot of time apologizing and making promises he couldn't keep. He was saved from having to unsummon it himself by the widespread acceptance that Kuro was so incompetent that he hadn't figured out how. There were many threats to just pop the thing, but fortunately most students were aware how unpleasant it was to absorb the memories from a traumatic unsummoning, so they were only threats. Kuro was grateful for that. If anyone had popped the dragon fey, he would have had a hard time explaining the results. Normally, the remains of a familiar streak back to its owner and weave into their brain. It would have been awkward if those streams of memory flew out the door instead of into his head. The most ardent voice against Kuro's familiar was Marie. She hated it. She was angry that it even existed. She wouldn't say it out loud, but the fact that Kuro, who couldn't do nearly any magic properly, could summon a familiar when she couldn't, was beyond what she could accept. When she found it rummaging through her belongings in her bedroom, it was the last straw. She threw the creature at Kuro and stormed away without saying a word. Kuro had never seen Marie upset enough to not even swear. After days of putting up with the troublemaking familiar, that was also Kuro's last straw. He was out of patience, and losing a friend for Bindle's benefit was straining his willingness to keep caring for the creature. He brought it to the graveyard with the intention of popping it if Bindle didn't come to take responsibility for the thing. Fortunately, Bindle did appear that night. Kuro was relieved because even though he'd told himself he would do it, he wasn't confident he could. He knew it wasn't really alive, and that familiars weren't supposed to care if they were destroyed, but that didn't make it any less real when he thought about smashing the curious creature with a rock.
"We are unsummoning your familiar right now," Kuro said with all the authority he could muster.
Bindle ignored him. Instead, he dove inside Kuro's bag for candy. He climbed back out with his jaw stuck closed by a mouthful of toffee and accused Kuro of stealing his sweets and trying to hide the evidence.
"It wasn't me," said Kuro. "It was your familiar. I wasn't hiding it from you. I was hiding it from that little beast. He likes candy more than you do."
Bindle nodded as though that were right and proper.
"We're unsummoning it," repeated Kuro.
Bindle pouted at the suggestion and crammed more candy into his mouth.
"If we unsummon it, you will get its memories," suggested Kuro. "Wasn't that the point of all of this?"
Bindle was only slightly moved by the argument.
"What if we can't make it again?" he replied. "We definitely can," said Kuro,
though he wasn't sure he was telling the truth.
"It will be easier. Also, you'll get to remember the candies it ate."
That was more than enough to get Bindle to change his tune.
"We will do it right now,"
he said, gulping down his mouthful of gingerbread. The unsummoning ritual was remarkably successful, though surprisingly uncomfortable. Since Kuro had helped make the familiar, that apparently meant the memories returned to Bindle via Kuro. They shot through his brain briefly, giving him impressions of sights and sounds and tastes and places that he'd never been, but leaving nothing but the faint sensation of having forgotten something in their wake. Bindle had quite the opposite experience. He reveled in the adventures the creature had gone on. The familiar, not bound by any of Bindle's promises or strict rules, had gone places, eaten things, and met people that Bindle had never been allowed. Even if the Luton was bossy and curt and treated Kuro as either a tamed monster or a servant, Kuro could still appreciate his feelings. It was freedom. Both spent their lives bound by others and trapped in rules and promises. A little bit of freedom was worth chasing. Bindle had unintentionally given Kuro more freedom than he had ever known, and Kuro was glad to repay the favor. He watched Bindle explore the new parts of his mind with a sense of pride and accomplishment. Bindle stopped marveling at his new memories and appeared as though he'd just seen something very distressing.
"What's wrong?" asked Kuro. "Did something bad happen to your familiar?"
Kuro imagined that the experience with Marie might have been a complicated one to digest. Bindle shook the unwelcome thoughts clear.
"Again," said Bindle. "We will make it again." "Not without a way to control it," said Kuro. "I'm going to get expelled if it causes any more trouble." "It will not cause trouble," Bindle asserted. "Let's make it now."
Kuro crossed his arms and refused to move.
"You promised," Bindle said, trying to convince Kuro that was part of his obligation. "I promised to teach you and to protect you," replied Kuro. "And your familiar is going to cause you trouble if it's not controlled. No summoning until we have a leash that it can't chew through."
Bindle vanished without a word. Kuro was left alone in the dark and chilly graveyard, wondering if that was the end of the argument. He eventually turned to leave and found the Luton blocking his exit with a chain in hand. It was the sort that was used in sinks to avoid losing the plug and included a metal ring that could be used as a collar. Kuro was annoyed that Bindle had been so quick to work around Kuro's ultimatum. They summoned and shackled the Dragon Fae. It yielded to the collar easily, probably knowing it needed to behave better, since it inherited some of Bindle's knowledge. He attached it to his satchel strap so that he could easily force it inside his bag should it misbehave. The creature tested its limits of the leash before moodily settling down on a shelf inside Kuro's bag. Kuro was about to lay down some more ground rules for him babysitting the monster when Bindle quickly said,
"Goodbye,"
and then vanished in a panic. Kuro felt it too. There were eyes on him.
Thank you for listening to Stealing from Wizards. If you liked our show, please consider rating or reviewing on iTunes. If you want to support this podcast or just can't wait for the next chapter, the full book is available on Amazon, Kobo, and Indigo. Our theme music was written by Camille Saint-Saëns, transcribed by Franz Liszt, performed by Rebecca Verdun, and used with permission. This episode was produced by Jim Tigwell.